I'm Maggie Creech, host of Revolution Revisited. If this podcast has changed how you think about the American Revolution or just made history come alive again, I'd love your help. Leave a rating or a short review wherever you listen. It only takes a minute, and it helps us amplify Virginia's history, connecting new listeners to the past and supporting the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Thank you for being part of the story.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. By the summer of 1775, Virginia was a colony perched on the knife's edge of rebellion. On one side stood Royal Governor Lord Dunmore, clinging to authority through threats, maneuvers, and the force of the crown. On the other hand, Virginia's patriots were increasingly bold, testing how far they could push without plunging the colony into outright war. Joining us to unpack this turbulent summer is...
My name is Sam Floor. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
This was a world of fragile truces and escalating provocations. Local committees of safety sprang up, towns prepared militias, and the colony's political leaders met in convention after convention, each gathering bringing them closer to revolution. Tensions weren't confined to politics. They also reached into daily life, reshaping social order, inflaming fears, and challenging loyalties. Last episode, we dove into how the colonies answered the chaos of the spring of 75 as they gathered at the Continental Congress to turn outrage into action. Today, we'll explore how Virginia, wealthy, powerful, and deeply divided, began to sharpen its teeth for revolution. From Henry's fiery call to arms to Lord Dunmore's threats of unleashing an uprising of enslaved people, which will get its own episode, to the formation of Virginia's first revolutionary military structures, this is the story of a colony caught in the storm.
To talk about the big things that happened, we need to step a little bit back and talk about context. So how did we get here? So remembering that the big things in Virginia really kick off in the spring. March is the Second Virginia Convention, Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech. Then in April is when the royal governor, Lord Dunmore, really riles things up with the gunpowder incident. He removes the gunpowder from the Williamsburg magazine. And that is really going to set off alarm bells with Virginia revolutionaries who are going to start arming themselves, forming militias, and preparing for an armed confrontation with Dunmore. Cooler heads prevail, and they are able to avoid any bloodshed or fighting in April and May. So when we move into June of 1775, things are very tense. We came right up to the edge of armed conflict, and both sides backed down. But both sides said a lot of mean things about one another, and those words they can't take back. So Lord Dunmore famously threatens to burn down Williamsburg and free all of the enslaved people in Virginia, which are white Virginians' greatest fear. So hard to say anything more incendiary than that. And Patrick Henry is, you know, calling Dunmore a tyrant and saying that he needs to be attacked and raises a group of armed men to go attack him. And they only stop at the very last minute. So both of those things that just happened are like in the front of everyone's minds. When they come to Williamsburg in June of 1775, when Dunmore is going to reconvene the House of Burgesses. So remember that the House of Burgesses last met more than a year earlier in May of 1774. That is when Dunmore will then dissolve the House of Burgesses after the Burgesses pass a resolution proclaiming a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, being in sympathy with the people of Boston after the Boston Tea Party and coercive acts. So he dissolved them in May, and they have not met again now until June. So he calls them back to meet in June of 1775, and he's calling them back to do a specific thing. And he is calling them to consider a conciliatory resolution proclamation that Lord North, who's the Prime Minister of England, and Parliament had recently passed. And basically, this conciliatory resolution was going to try to find a way forward out of this imperial crisis. So it was going to rescind all of the taxes that Parliament had previously passed, but it was not going to get rid of the need for that money. Parliament was going to force the local legislatures in the colonies to come up with that money themselves, but Parliament was going to set the amount of money that all of the colonies were going to have to provide. So it was trying to get out of the like direct taxation from Parliament, but it was still the money that Parliament wanted out of the colonies was still going to have to be provided in some way. And so the colonists saw this as not going far enough. It didn't address any of the baseline issues of who had the right to tax who. That was left unsaid. So it kind of left room in the future, maybe for these taxes to come back. And so when the colonists first hear about this, they're not overjoyed. They're not like, okay, this is the deal that we've been looking for. We can maybe find a way out of this.
When Lord Dunmore called the House of Burgesses back into session in June 1775, the air was thick with tension. This was the same body he had dismissed more than a year earlier, and many of the same men who had spent that year gathering in extra-legal conventions and even in continental congresses, were now returning to their seats. Peyton Randolph, who had presided over these revolutionary gatherings and served as president of the Continental Congress, once again held the speaker's chair, straddling the line between colonial officialdom and insurgent leadership. To be honest, it was complicated on all sides. Dunmore opened the session with restraint. He did not bring up Patrick Henry's armed threat against him, nor his own incendiary warnings about burning Williamsburg and freeing Virginia's enslaved population. Instead, he tried to strike a conciliatory tone. He urged the Burgesses to consider Parliament's new proposal, which promised to repeal direct taxes, but still required the colonies to raise whatever sums Parliament demanded. For London, this was crucial. If Virginia could be persuaded to accept, it might fracture the united colonial front and weaken Congress's growing authority. And the Virginia Burgesses? They were cautious, but some were hopeful. After months of tension and shadow governments, the return of the House of Burgesses suggested a fleeting sense of normalcy, a chance that regular governance might resume. They even began with routine business, petitions, reimbursements, and the dull but necessary work of a government long dormant. They formed a committee to deliberate over the conciliatory resolution. And for a brief moment, it seemed as though cooperation, or at least coexistence, might be possible. But that fragile normalcy would not last. Within days, events outside Williamsburg would shatter the careful balance, and with it, the last illusions that Virginia could turn back from the path to revolution.
Just 2 days later, on June the 3rd, 1775, a group of young men are going to break into the magazine in Williamsburg. And Dunmore had anticipated that there might be more trouble at the magazine. People had already broken into it, you know, after the gunpowder incident. So he puts a trap gun inside of the magazine. And this is basically a shotgun that's hooked up to a wire, and it's meant to prevent robberies. So these young guys, they open a door, the gun goes off, and several of them were wounded. One loses a couple fingers on his hand. When news of this gets out, the people of Williamsburg are really mad. They say that if any of them had died, Dunmore would have deserved the label of murderer. That's like printed in the Virginia Gazette. Even Edmund Pendleton, who is one of the more moderate of these revolutionaries, he says that Dunmore would have rightly deserved the label of an assassin and would have been deserving of assassination himself. So really a jump in rhetoric from this like calm, we're going to find a way forward, to now we're calling Dunmore a murderer again. And so Dunmore is going to be in his palace. He denies putting the trap gun in the magazine. And we don't have any explicit proof that he ordered that, but it makes sense that he probably was behind it and not just some bureaucrat who decided to put a gun in it. But maybe it was just that bureaucrat. We don't really know. It's lost to history. But regardless, people are going to get mad. More of these armed militia guys are going to come from the surrounding countryside. They're going to be literally marching around the streets of Williamsburg with guns in their hands. Dunmore is going to complain that his house was kept, quote, in continual alarm and threatened every night with an assault. After just a few days, Dunmore realizes it's no longer safe for him and his family to stay in town. So on June the 8th, 1775, in the middle of the night, he and his family and some of his closest confidants will slip out of the palace, go down to a warship that's anchored in the York River, and he will leave Williamsburg for good. So June the 8th, 1775 is the last time there's any official royal authority left in the capital of Williamsburg. The Burgesses are going to be like, they're going to wake up the next day, and Dunmore had literally left them a note telling them that he had left.
The next morning, the Burgesses arrived ready to resume business, only to find a note explaining he had fled. Shocked, they pleaded with him to return, insisting he was never in danger. But Dunmore, now anchored aboard a ship in the York River, refused. He pointed to the armed young men patrolling the streets and said plainly, he did not trust them, and he had reason to worry. With the governor gone, these same young men broke into the governor's palace, not once, but twice. They stripped the walls of muskets and sabers meant to symbolize British power, ignoring the Burgesses' direct orders not to do so. Thomas Jefferson even bemoaned that the utmost efforts of the more intelligent people were required to restrain the people's ungovernable fury. Meanwhile, an awkward dance of government limped along. From Williamsburg, the Burgesses sent bills to Dunmore for approval, including measures to purchase gunpowder and arms for the colony. Dunmore, of course, refused this. Letters were exchanged, invitations to meet were offered and declined. This was politics masquerading as normalcy, a government in denial. But by late June, reality set in. With Dunmore unwilling to return, the Burgesses acknowledged that without a governor, they could not legally function.
So they adjourn at the end of June 1775. And immediately afterwards, Peyton Randolph, who is serving as the Speaker of the House, he is now going to call a meeting of the revolutionary governing body, the convention. So he calls for a third Virginia convention to meet in Richmond at the beginning of July of 1775. So in between this time, in between June and July, there is no governing body sitting in Virginia. The governor is in a warship in a river. The House of Burgesses is not meeting. There's no Virginia convention meeting. So there literally is no official governing body in charge of anything in Virginia for a period of several weeks. And into that void is going to grow these independent companies, these young men, these volunteers that are going to become even more unruly than they have been. So they break into the governor's palace, they break into the magazine, they take all of the guns out, they give it to their friends. More of them come to Williamsburg. The city leaders of Williamsburg asked for reinforcements. They were worried that Dunmore might bring some of his soldiers and sailors that were on board those ships and try to do something, try to retake Williamsburg in some kind of military action. So they call for reinforcements to protect the capital. And a lot of these guys will answer the call. And these young men are different than like the initial volunteer. So it's interesting. In the fall of 1774, winter of 1775, when these independent companies, these militia groups first form, these are forming after the First Continental Congress. They're trying to enforce this boycott, this Continental Association. A lot of these volunteers are gentlemen. They are like the gentry, the elite, and they're doing this as a sign of their revolutionary patriotic fervor. But it's a really small group of men, maybe just a dozen, two dozen in each of these counties. Well, after the gunpowder incident in April of 1775, things are now a lot more serious, right? And so you see dozens and dozens, hundreds of young men from all these counties are going to come out and want to join these militia groups, these independent companies. And this is going to change the composition of these groups. Before, they were these orderly, they were like the leadership class. But now they're a much more broad representative class of middle and lower class Virginians who are in these militia groups that had been created by the gentry. And so the gentry was not prepared for the lower classes to join them in this effort. And they're going to start getting concerned because these independent companies elected their own officers initially. And that was fine when you're all rich and from the same class. But now when there's these lower class people, maybe they're not going to elect the people you want them to. They're also going to have maybe different motives and different objectives, right? So the gentry class was very much about keeping control. They didn't want things to get too out of control. Or these younger guys are much more willing to push the envelope. You see, when these larger groups of men come to Williamsburg, they will start harassing everybody. So if you are a loyalist, they might come to your house, bring you before some kind of ad hoc tribunal, interrogate you, try you, and force you out of your home, force you out of your community. If you're neutral, if you haven't said which side you're going to join yet, but if you haven't joined their side, they're going to consider you an enemy. And we see people like William Byrd is a great example. He was one of the wealthiest, most influential men in Virginia, but he was kind of lukewarm towards the revolution. He didn't think that all these revolutionary actions were quite necessary yet and wanted to wait and see how things played out. So he complains about these militiamen coming to his home on several different occasions, interrogating him and threatening him into, why haven't you joined us yet? Why haven't you signed up? The revolutionary leaders, who are mostly these more moderate guys, are really concerned about this because it risks alienating a lot of people in Virginia who might be neutral. And they know that they're going to need them eventually to join them. But if they threaten them, that's going to make their cause much less appealing, right? If people are saying, you know, if you're being threatened by all these rabble rousers with guns, that is a lot of the atmosphere behind calling this Third Virginia Convention, is because they realize that they need to get control over these rabble rousers. And there's some great quotes about this military chaos and feeling that is throughout all the colonies at the time.
Williamsburg was brimming with energy and young men itching for a fight. One observer wrote that Mars, the great god of battle, is now honored in every part of this spacious colony. Every presence is warlike, every sound is martial, drums beating, fifes and bagpipes playing. Another remarked that every rank and denomination of people seemed swept up in martial notions. This wasn't just an elite affair. The fever for revolution was everywhere. But with hundreds of young men flooding into town, discipline quickly frayed. They elected Charles Scott as their commander, but since he held the job by popular vote, he hesitated to be too strict. The punishments they set for misbehavior? 2 hours without food, a public scolding, or, after 3 strikes, getting kicked out. Not quite the iron fist of military order. Predictably, chaos followed. Muskets cracked through the night sky, taverns overflowed with drunken recruits, locals were harassed, and the mischievous antics escalated into something more serious. Some militia decided Dunmore might seize colonial tax revenues, so they beat him to it, storming collectors and walking away with thousands of pounds. Patriotism mixed with opportunism, and suddenly, Virginia's young hotheads were raiding the treasury. When the Third Virginia Convention gathered, they addressed this first. While they praised the spirit, they firmly told the independent companies to knock it off. The revolution might have been sparked by youthful fire, but it couldn't survive on drunk bravado and midnight musket fire. It needed order, it needed leadership, and it needed a real structure, or else Virginia's bid for liberty would collapse under its own chaos.
Where the revolutionary leadership needs the lower middle classes to go along with them for this effort to succeed. But at the same time, they want to control that lower and middle class. It's this balancing act of not allowing the revolution to get too revolutionary, because this is a great example, right? They have lost control of a lot of these people. And right now, they're not directing any of that military force against them, but they could. And there's been long, you know, generations of tensions between the lower and middle classes and the gentry class. 50% of all Virginians don't own any land at all. And it's this small 10% gentry class that owns half of all of the land in the colony. So like the class and wealth discrepancies in the colony are humongous. And everybody knows that. And so they are very worried about this.
The Third Virginia Convention convened in the summer of 1775, meeting from July 17th through August 26th. Once again, the delegates gathered at St. John's Church in Richmond, the same spot where Patrick Henry had declared, "Give me liberty or give me death," just a few months earlier. The choice of location was deliberate. By moving the assembly out of Williamsburg, they put distance between themselves and Governor Dunmore, a precaution in case he attempted to arrest them or shut down their proceedings. This was no ordinary meeting. With the royal governor absent and the official colonial government paralyzed, the convention was now the de facto authority in Virginia. And the question before them was urgent: how to transform Virginia's revolutionary energy into an organized military force capable of defending the colony.
The Third Virginia Convention is going to give teeth now to the revolution. They're going to start forming a revolutionary governing body to fill the void that the House of Burgesses no longer meeting has left, and that the departure of Dunmore from Williamsburg has left. So that is their principal objective, is to form a governing body and also to form and to organize this martial spirit that has infected everyone in Virginia. They need to direct that spirit into a body that they can control and that they can have leadership over. The main things that they do are create a three-tiered military force.
At its core were two regiments of regulars, professional full-time soldiers. Each regiment numbered about 500 men drawn from the counties across Virginia so that no single region shouldered the entire burden. These men would be salaried, trained, clothed, and armed by the revolutionary government. For the first time, Virginia had something that looked like a real standing army. Supporting them was a second tier, the Minutemen. Borrowed from New England's model, these were part-time soldiers expected to be ready at a moment's notice. Organized into companies of 60 to 100 men, the Minutemen were meant to provide flexibility and speed in case of sudden conflict. And beneath them was the broad base of the militia. Legally, all white men in the colony were required to serve. The militia was less disciplined, less well-equipped, but it represented the sheer weight of numbers Virginia could call upon in a crisis. Together, these layer of troops, regulars, minutemen, and militia, formed the backbone of Virginia's new revolutionary military structure. It was an ambitious plan, reflecting the reality that the colony was no longer simply protesting British policy. It was preparing for war.
But the Minutemen will be basically a small cadre of more well-trained militia. So the militia does not train very often. They're meant to be literally like citizen soldiers and just come out in times of crises. But the Minutemen are supposed to be trained several more times every year. So when a crisis does happen, they can immediately go to that crisis and deal with it, as opposed to the militia, who might take more time to get supplied and organized and then react to it. So the Minuteman system is effective in New England. The Battle of Lexington and Concord, a lot of those Minutemen will come out and confront the British there. Interestingly, though, it's not all Minutemen. It's a lot of just regular New England militia guys who also come out. So in Virginia, they're trying to create a similar model of more well-trained militia. So this is a big force. They create 16 500-man battalions or regiments that are supposed to be all throughout Virginia. So 8,000 Minutemen soldiers that the government will also supply, give arms and equipment to.
With Virginia setting out to mobilize thousands of men, one of the biggest questions was simple. Where does all of the stuff come from? Guns, uniforms, food, supplies? These things do not appear out of thin air. And while money could be printed, material resources were far harder to manufacture. By October 1775, Virginia had managed to raise nearly 1,000 regular soldiers, but the Minutemen system, designed to supplement them, ran into serious problems. Men who had originally volunteered in independent militia companies, choosing their own officers and serving as equals, were now told that they had to join a new structure. In this system, officers were appointed by county committees of safety, not elected by the men themselves. The spirit of independence that had fueled early volunteerism didn't translate well into a rigid hierarchy, On top of that, there was the pay. The wide disparity between officers and enlisted men bred resentment. What had begun as an egalitarian, volunteer-driven movement now felt more like a professional army, something many Virginians hadn't bargained for. The result was that while Virginia could raise troops, keeping them supplied, organized, motivated, and paid was another battle entirely.
The pay discrepancy between officers and enlisted men is huge, and that's on purpose. So interestingly, when we'll talk about Patrick Henry is elected the military commander of all these forces, and he is paid 40 pounds a month, where one of these enlisted soldiers in the regular regiments are paid 8 shillings a day. That pay discrepancy is almost 100 times. Patrick Henry was earning 100 times more than the average soldier. As you go down in the ranks, the pay is lower and the discrepancy is not as big, but it's still several times pay discrepancy. And that was on purpose. Officers and the traditional political leadership at that time firmly believed that officers had to be paid more than the enlisted soldiers, because if not, they would be too equal to one another. And then the officers would not have as much authority over the enlisted men. George Washington himself believed really strongly in this pay discrepancy to give officers the authority they needed to command their men. Otherwise, he believed, quote, the men would consider and treat him as an equal and regard him no more than a broomstick, being mixed together as one common herd. No order, no discipline can prevail. So you don't want to be a broomstick commanding a company, a regiment of soldiers. You need to be the big guy in charge so everyone listens to you. So this was this really firm belief in the 18th century in this like class discrepancy between officers and men. And the lower class, middle class guys who initially came out for these independent companies are now going to be like, hey, what's going on? I thought we were all in this together. And now you're telling me that I have to like take my place under you in this system. So they're going to be really upset about that. And then they're also going to be upset because these independent companies were everybody coming together was mixing the classes of Virginians. They were seen as equals to the gentry who also were volunteering. But now that the Minuteman system comes into play, all the gentry guys are going to wait to be appointed officers in either the regular forces or in the Minuteman forces. They're not signing up as just Joe Schmo enlisted soldiers. And all the middle and lower class men are going to say, well, hey, what's going on? I thought we were all in this together. And now you're not joining because you're waiting for one of these cushy officer positions. And now it's all on us to join and be the average soldiers getting paid not very much, being ordered around. So for all of those reasons, for not being able to elect their officers, for the pay discrepancy, because the gentry are not signing up as average soldiers, a lot of the middle and lower class men will say, well, we're not going to sign up either.
Virginia's revolutionary movement in 1775 exposed deep tensions beneath the surface. Socioeconomic divides created a rift in the ranks. The Minuteman system, intended to organize the colony's part-time soldiers, often frustrated volunteers. Many felt the burden fell disproportionately on the poor, while officers, appointed rather than elected, received higher pay. Revolutionary fervor from the spring and early summer began to dissipate as the convention imposed order, revealing that unity was more aspiration than reality. Supplies were another constant challenge. Guns, gunpowder, uniforms, and other essentials didn't appear overnight. The Virginia Committee of Safety worked tirelessly, purchasing weapons abroad, establishing local manufacturing, and collecting supplies from counties to ensure the professional regiments were prioritized, followed by the Minutemen and then the broader militia, who were expected to largely provide for themselves. Meanwhile, Virginia was not alone. North and South Carolina followed a similar path, forming revolutionary conventions and organizing militias alongside professional troops. Both colonies faced internal tensions with loyalist populations, especially in backcountry regions where settlers resisted the coastal gentry's revolutionary leadership. Skirmishes erupted as early as the fall of 1775, echoing Virginia's struggles with organization, supplies, and social divisions. Further north in New England, the situation escalated even faster. Thousands of militias laid siege to Boston, and the British army was entrenched in the city. While Virginia's revolutionaries were still consolidating forces, supplies, and command structures, war was already raging elsewhere, a stark reminder that the conflict they were preparing for was no longer theoretical.
This is all going to come to a head with the Battle of Bunker Hill on June 17th, 1775. And this was a huge escalation in the conflict. Lexington and Concord was bloody. Several hundred men were killed on either side. But Bunker Hill is definitely a step up from that. There were several thousand militiamen entrenched behind fortifications on Charlestown Neck outside of Boston. The British land 2,000 soldiers to like storm those fortifications. They set fire to the city of Charlestown. They bombard the city with their big ships. And over 1,000 British soldiers are killed and wounded in this battle. That's almost 50% of their forces that they use. That's a big deal. Like, this is a big, bloody battle. And that is going to go a long ways towards escalating the conflict, right? Because blood had been shed and people were like, I think we're going to have to fight a war. But maybe Lexington and Concord could have been a one-off, right? That we had this violent conflict, but we were able to take a step back. Bunker Hill is clearly showing it's going to be very hard to take a step back from this conflict. At the same time, in Philadelphia, we have the Second Continental Congress. They are continentalizing the army outside of Boston. The leaders of this militia army had asked Congress to do so. They said, hey, there's a lot of us here, and we need higher authority to like keep us together and to give us instructions on what we should do. So Congress agrees. They continentalize the army, create the Continental Army on June 14th, 1775. They also are going to ask other colonies to contribute soldiers to this army outside of Boston. They ask for 10 companies of riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia to form and march to Boston. Virginia will send two companies. These are riflemen from the western, northwestern part of the state near like Shepherdstown, today, West Virginia, and then around Winchester, Virginia. One of those companies will be led by Daniel Morgan. He becomes a very famous, well-known Continental Army officer during the war. And when they march to Boston, it becomes known as the Beeline March because they march almost 500 miles in like 25 days. They're marching like 20 miles a day, trying to get to Boston as quickly as possible. And it was this great show wherever they marched. Everyone came out and gave them food and water and cheered them on. So this is showing the war is escalating, right? The Continental Army is forming. They select George Washington famously as the commander of the Continental Army. They're sending forces from other colonies to join the New Englanders. So this is becoming more than just a war in New England. This is becoming a continental-wide effort.
As the Third Virginia Convention worked to organize the colony's revolutionary forces, a major question loomed. Who would lead them? Patrick Henry, ever the firebrand, wanted the top position. At the time, he was in Philadelphia, but he quickly set out for Virginia to make his case. Henry's motivation was partly personal. He felt his voice was being drowned out in the Continental Congress, but it was also practical. The war had already begun, and his radical ideas were no longer quite so radical. The crisis he had predicted was unfolding. Taking command of Virginia's military would put him back at the center of action. Of course, Henry had no military experience. He had been a trial lawyer, not a battlefield commander. Yet, his popularity with middle and lower class Virginians made him a powerful political asset. The convention's leadership saw that giving Henry a formal role could channel his influence, maintain popular support, and keep revolutionary energy alive while imposing the discipline and structure necessary for an army. Debates over his appointment were heated, reflecting the broader tension in the convention. How to balance experienced leadership, political strategy, and the fiery enthusiasm of the population. Henry's bid for command highlights the delicate dance of the revolution in Virginia, where politics, personality, and public support were as critical as muskets and gunpowder.
Patrick Henry is finally elected the commander of the 1st Virginia Regiment, and because he was given his commission, his military command first, that means that he was technically the highest commander in Virginia. But there's two of these regiments. So that 2nd Regiment was given to a man named William Woodford. He served as a young man in the French and Indian War. He did have military experience, and he came from the very moderate gentry elite of Virginia. He was good friends and a protege of Edmund Pendleton, the most moderate of these revolutionaries. And so they saw Woodford as a way to kind of balance out Patrick Henry's radicalism. And crucially, they felt okay about it because the convention makes it very clear that the military is subservient to their control. They make very clear that civilian command oversees the military efforts. They forbid any military officer from serving in the convention, from serving in the Committee of Safety, their executive body, as we'll talk about, or serving in the Continental Congress as a representative from Virginia. So they say, if you're in the military, you can have no civilian leadership at the same time. And they thought that was important, especially when thinking about Patrick Henry, who's this generally popular guy. They don't want him to become basically a dictator of being a military commander and the civilian political commander at the same time. So with those regulations in place, they feel that Henry can be controlled. And as we'll see later, when it comes to actually fighting the battles against Dunmore, they don't send Henry. They send William Woodford, the guy who I think is more in line with them ideologically and politically. They send him to confront Dunmore.
Even though Patrick Henry had sought command of Virginia's forces, the convention's civilian leadership largely sidelined him. They issued orders directly to officers like William Woodford, effectively cutting Henry out of day-to-day operations. Back in Williamsburg, during the escalating conflicts with Dunmore, Henry was left stewing, frustrated that his influence had been curtailed. Not everyone thought he was the right choice. George Washington later remarked that placing Henry in the field was a mistake, suggesting that a voluntary resignation might have avoided unnecessary difficulties. Henry's appointment wasn't about military skill. It was a political decision meant to keep popular support alive while the convention established a disciplined chain of command. With leadership sorted, the convention moved on to other critical tasks, laying the groundwork for Virginia's revolutionary governance and military organization.
The convention creates an executive body that will control the colony, the revolutionary movement, whenever the convention, the legislative body, is not sitting in session. So this becomes known as Virginia's Committee of Safety. It was an 11-man body, and the Committee of Safety is going to be given extraordinary powers. It's going to be given the power to command Virginia's military forces. It will be given the power to raise money to pay for these forces. It will be given power to set up state-run industrial foundries and salt production. They give them all this power to basically create a Virginia wartime economy. And these are powers that a colonial governor of Virginia never had. The governor of Virginia could command the militia, but only really if the House of Burgesses paid for that militia. And that was only for small, specific periods of time. Whereas this Committee of Safety is controlling a full-time armed army of revolutionaries. So that's a big escalation. And this committee is supposed to make decisions as a body, but it does have a leader, and that leader is Edmund Pendleton. Pendleton was chosen for his moderation. He did not agree with Patrick Henry. He thought that Henry's actions in the gunpowder incident and confronting Dunmore were too rash and threatened the stability of the revolutionary movement. And so when the convention chooses Pendleton to serve as the leader of this committee, they are again showing that they are trying to rein in the chaos that was going on during the summer. The last thing that the Third Virginia Convention is going to do is they are going to also exert more control over the local county committees of safety. So remember, these local committees of safety were formed throughout the fall of 1774, spring of 1775. These were these local elected revolutionary bodies that were meant to enforce the Continental Association. They helped form these independent companies, this initial military response. So this is the on-the-ground revolutionary leadership of Virginia. But most of these local committees of safety were elected back in the fall of 1774, when a lot of people didn't know what these bodies were going to be doing. They didn't even know, in some cases, that they were going to have an election. They would maybe call for a meeting in a county to talk about the Continental Association, and maybe not everyone showed up, and then those guys that were there were like, okay, well, we actually need some men to lead this effort. And they were like, oh, I will vote for you and you. And so it was like these very undemocratic elections that were electing hodgepodges of people. In some counties, it was a dozen men. In other counties, it was 70 people who was serving on this like mega committee. And so these local counties, there's not a lot of uniformity. Many of them had not been reelected since a year prior. The Third Virginia Convention sees the need to reorganize these local committees that are going to be enforcing and raising these bodies of armed men and enforcing all these regulations that they're going to be passing. So they mandate that all of these local counties have to hold elections once every year. They mandate their size. They say they can be no larger than 21 people. And they are also stressing that they elect, quote, like the best people in their county, too. So they're also urging the local leadership to make sure that the gentry, the more moderate people, are being elected to this, right? Not the, like the lower and middle classes that might disrupt things. So that's another important thing that the Virginia Convention will do.
Even as Virginia's revolutionaries built a new army and governing structure, they weren't alone in worrying about control. Across the colonies, leaders recognized that militias and volunteers, thousands of armed men suddenly mobilized, could just as easily slip into chaos. In Massachusetts, Joseph Warren warned Samuel Adams that unless civil authority remained firmly in charge, the soldiers might abandon discipline altogether, turning from protectors into plunderers. The same anxiety drove Virginia's leaders to impose order before their own movement unraveled. By late August 1775, the Third Virginia Convention brought its work to a close. They had achieved their major goals: creating a professional army, establishing the Committee of Safety to act when the convention was not in session, and reorganizing local committees to enforce revolutionary measures on the ground. But the debate had been bitter and exhausting. Moderates like Robert Wormley Carter complained that the convention was constantly undoing its own work. George Mason admitted that he nearly despaired, describing the sessions as so fractious that procrastination was often the only way to prevent rash decisions. When the convention finally adjourned, it issued its proceedings to the public and carefully framed its actions. All blame, they said, rested on Governor Dunmore, on his threats, his incitement of enslaved people, and his refusal to return those who had fled to him. And yet, strikingly, they ended with words of loyalty, a declaration of continued allegiance to King George III, and a promise to disband their forces if tranquility were restored. Of course, those terms were impossible. To restore Virginia's trust would have required Parliament and the King to remake imperial governance from the ground up. In effect, Virginians were saying they would remain loyal only if Britain agreed to a new system that gave them near independence in practice. It was traditional language masking a radical reality, one that many observers already recognized as the path toward full revolution. By mid-1775, Dunmore had fled Williamsburg and set up in Norfolk. Through the summer and fall, he escalated tensions. July brought British reinforcements from Florida. September saw him seize a local printing press, and by October and November, the first real clashes broke out at Hampton and around Norfolk. Meanwhile, in London, George III had already decided the colonies were in open revolt. He refused to even read the Olive Branch petition and instead issued his Declaration of Rebellion in August. News of that reached Virginia in November, and by then, armed conflict was already underway. And just days later, Dunmore followed with his own proclamation, formally aligning Virginia's crisis with the King's. While Dunmore and the Virginia Convention are locked in this escalating standoff, we can't forget that many of these same leaders are also shuttling back and forth to Philadelphia. The Second Continental Congress doesn't just meet once and dissolve. It sits for years. And Virginians like Jefferson, Henry, and Randolph are constantly moving between state and national politics, carrying the tension of one arena straight into the other.
Most of the time, they either are in Virginia or they're in Philadelphia. So when the Third Virginia Convention meets, they reelect delegates to go to Philadelphia. And it's not Edmund, like Edmund Pendleton had gone before. He was in Philadelphia when they call the Second Virginia Convention, and he leaves to come back to Virginia to be a part of those debates. And then he is going to stay in Virginia because he was elected to Virginia leadership roles, and they elect new men to go back to Philadelphia. Also, you do see some overlap. So like Thomas Jefferson was serving in Philadelphia, and he comes in at the end of these debates at the Third Virginia Convention because his wife was sick. And so he was coming back to Virginia to see her, and he stops off in Richmond and participates in the Third Virginia Convention. But it's not like he had resigned his seat. He then goes back to Philadelphia. Typically, that is what's happening. They're choosing as individuals, or the bodies are electing them, whether they're going to represent Virginia nationally in Congress or locally back in Virginia.
And since the Continental Congress didn't just dissolve and reform like Virginia's conventions, but instead carried on for years, representation was fluid. Delegates cycled in and out, as their colonies recalled them, elected replacements, or sent new voices to Philadelphia mid-session. It wasn't about strict terms or even regional balance so much as keeping the seats filled with whoever the colony trusted to carry their interests at the moment.
So while they don't have regulations that state that, I think internally they do try to have some broader representation of ideas and regions. I think they do try to do that because this is, at the end of the day, it's politics too, right? So these are politicians, right? And there are different factions and different groups. While they don't have parties, there are different groups of guys that come together and they agree with one another. And so they're electing both the people that they agree with, but they also recognize they need to elect some of the people they might not agree with. So there is broader representation of these ideas.
They make it sound like they're these masters of self-regulation, but let's be real. This is still a room full of men arguing with each other. What's fascinating is how they balanced their local versus national roles. At a Virginia convention, they were fighting for their colony's immediate needs. In Philadelphia, they had to posture for Virginia's place in the bigger picture. Sometimes that meant political chess, like when Virginia made Patrick Henry governor. He was too popular to sideline, but they also stripped the office of real power, basically giving him a title to keep him busy while keeping him out of the House of Delegates, where he could really stir the pot. Most of what we've been talking about is centered in the Tidewater, in places like Williamsburg, Yorktown, later Norfolk, and even up to Richmond. But the Revolution wasn't just a coastal story. These debates and decisions rippled out across Virginia, into the South Side, into the Western counties, into small towns where neighbors gathered to argue loyalty and revolution. They were raising militia companies, holding meetings, and deciding what side they stood on. One powerful example comes from Dunmore County, which we know today as Shenandoah County. And in fact, during the war itself, they changed their name, as if to erase any trace of the royal governor they were now rejecting. Our collection gives us this remarkable glimpse through two letters written by a man named William Clark in the summer of 1775. In the first, Clark is defiant. He's been summoned before his local committee of safety, and he flatly refuses. He calls them an illegal assembly. He accuses them of treasonable proceedings, and he insists that he feels perfect indifference towards whatever punishments they might throw his way. But then, just a few pages later, in the very same folder, we found another letter. And here, it's almost the opposite. Now, Clark is swearing loyalty to Congress, vowing never to speak ill of the committees, and even promising to leave his town within 10 minutes and not return for a year. It's an astonishing reversal, and we don't know exactly what changed his mind. Was it fear? Pressure from neighbors? A threat too heavy to ignore? Whatever happened, William Clark's words remind us that the revolution wasn't a neat march towards independence. It was messy. It was personal. It was neighbors calling each other traitors one day and pledging loyalty the next. And in those small shifts, in men like William Clark, we see the revolution not just as a grand declaration, but as a daily choice, contested and recontested in communities across Virginia.
I think this is a great example of things like this are happening all across Virginia at this time when the revolution is getting teeth. They are forcing people to choose sides. You're either with us or you're against us. And Dunmore is then going to do the same thing in the fall. He is going to say, you're either with me or against me. So it's pushing a lot of neutrals into either camp. And you see the revolution were these big ideas, but now it's like a reality. What are you going to do as an average Virginia colonist? Which side are you going to choose? And there is no right answer, right? If you live in Dunmore County, you might need to choose the revolutionary side or else you're going to be forced from town. But if you live in Norfolk, where Dunmore has, you know, a fleet of ships and he is starting to raise his army of his own, you're probably going to make a different choice because different people are pointing guns at you. So I think that's really important to keep in mind, too, that people's loyalties a lot of the time are going to depend on like what's happening around them and their very specific circumstances.
When we step back from the big declarations, the congresses, and the famous names, what we see is a revolution lived out in letters, in county meetings, in the pressure of neighbors watching neighbors. Independence wasn't inevitable. It was contested. It was fragile. It was messy. And it's in those messy, very human moments that we glimpse the revolution, not as a myth, but as reality. Ordinary people wrestling with extraordinary change.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Riley Reynolds, Nicole Martorana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.